was swept off the stairwell by the bright lights blooming inside. It hadn't been widely publicized, but the reason for the severe power restrictions on other levels was largely due to the exemption IT maintained it possessed in spite of this holiday. Bernard had pointed to various clauses in the pact to support this. Juliet had bitched that servers shouldn't get priority over grow lights, but resigned herself to getting the main generator realigned and taking what she could. Jeanne's told Juliet to view this as her first lesson in political compromise. Juliet said she saw it as a display of weakness. Inside, Jeanne's found Bernard waiting on them, a look on his face like he'd swallowed sour fruit juice. A conversation between several IT workers standing off to the side quickly silenced with their entry, leaving Jeanne's little doubt that they'd been spotted on the way up and expected.
"Bernard," she said, trying to keep her breathing steady.
She didn't want him to know how tired she was. Let him think she was strolling by on her way up from the down deep, like it was no big deal.
"Marie."
It was a deliberate slight. He didn't even look Marnes's way or acknowledge that the deputy was in the room.
"Would you like to sign these here or in the conference room?"
She dug into her bag for the contract with Juliet's name on it.
"What games are you playing at, Marie?"
Jeanne's felt her temperature rise. The cluster of workers in silver IT jumpsuits were following the exchange.
"Playing at?" she asked. "You think this power holiday of yours is cute? Your way of getting back at me?"
"Getting back?"
"I've got servers, Marie."
"Your servers have their full allocation of power," Jeanne's reminded him, her voice rising.
"But their cooling comes ducted from mechanical, and if temps get any higher, we'll be ramping down, which we've never had to do."
Marnes stepped between the two of them, his hands raised.
"Easy,"
he said, coolly, his gaze on Bernard.
"Call off your little shadow here,"
Bernard said. Jeanne's placed a hand on Marnes's arm.
"The pact is clear, Bernard. It's my choice, my nomination. You and I have a nice history of signing off on each other's, and I told you this girl from the pits will not do."
"Well, she's got the job,"
Marnes said, interrupting. Jeanne's noticed his hand had fallen to the butt of his gun. She wasn't sure if Bernard noticed or not, but he fell silent. His eyes, however, did not leave Jeanne's.
"I won't sign it." "Well, then next time I won't ask."
Bernard smiled.
"You think you'll outlive another sheriff?"
He turned toward the workers in the corner and waved one of them over.
"Why do I somehow doubt that?"
The worker approached. Bernard nodded to the young man, a face familiar to Jeanne's from level meetings.
"Sign whatever she needs. I refuse to. Make copies. Take care of the rest."
He waved his hand dismissively, turned and looked Marnes and Jeanne's up and down one final time, as if disgusted with their condition, their age, their positions, something.
"Oh, and top off their canteens and see that they have enough food to stagger back to their homes, whatever it takes to power their decrepit legs to wherever it is that they belong."
And with that, Bernard strode off toward the barred gates that led into the heart of IT, back to his brightly lit offices where servers hummed happily, the temperature rising in the slow-moving air like the heat of angered flesh as capillaries squeezed, the blood in them rising to a boil. 8. The floors flew by faster as they approached home. In the darkest sections of the staircase, between quiet floors of people hunkered down and awaiting a return to normalcy, old hands wrapped around each other and swung between two climbers, brazenly and open, grasping each other while their other hands slid up the cool steel of the rails. Jeanne's only let go sporadically to check that her walking stick was secure against her back, or to grab Marnes's canteen from his pack and take a sip. They had taken to drinking each other's water, it being easier to reach across than around one's own back. There was a sweetness to it as well, this carrying the sustenance another needed, this being able to provide and reciprocate in a perfectly equitable relationship. It was a thing worth dropping hands for, momentarily, at least. Jean's finished a sip, screwed on the metal cap with its dangling chain, and replaced it in his outer pouch. She was dying to know if things would be different once they got back. They were only 20 floors away. An impossible distance yesterday now seemed like something that could slip away without noticing. And as they arrived, would familiar surroundings bring familiar roles? Would last night feel more and more like a dream? Or would old ghosts become more and more solid? She wanted to ask these things, but talked of trivialities instead. When would Jules, as she insisted they call her, be ready for duty? What case files did he and Holston have open that needed tending to first? What concession would they make to keep IT happy, to calm down Bernard? And how would they handle Peter Billings' disappointment? What impact would this have on hearings he might one day preside over as judge? Jeanne's felt butterflies in her stomach as they discussed these things. Or perhaps it was the nerves of all she wanted to say but couldn't. These topics were as numerous as grains of dust in the outside air, and just as likely to dry her mouth and still her tongue. She found herself drinking more and more from his thermos, her own water making noises at her back, her stomach lurching with every landing. Each number counting down toward the conclusion of their journey, an adventure that had been a complete success in so many ways. To start with, they had their sheriff, a fiery girl from the down deep who seemed every bit as confident and inspiring as Marnes had intimated. Jean saw her kind as the future of the silo, people who thought long-term, who planned, who got things done. There was precedence of sheriffs running for mayor. She thought Juliet would eventually make a fine choice. And speaking of running, the trip had fired up her own goals and ambitions. She was excited for the upcoming elections, however unopposed she might be, and had even come up with dozens of short speeches during the climb. She saw how things could run better, how she could perform her duties more diligently, and how the silo could have new life breathed into old bones. But the biggest change was whatever had grown between herself and Marnes. She had even begun to suspect, just in the last hours, that the real reason for him never taking a promotion was because of her. As deputy, there was enough space between them to contain his hope, his impossible dream of holding her. As sheriff, it couldn't happen. Too much conflict of interest, too much his immediate superior. This theory of hers contained a powerful sadness and an awe-inspiring sweetness. She squeezed his hand as she thought on this theory, and it filled her with a deep hollowness, a cramp in her gut at all he had silently sacrificed, a massive debt to live up to no matter what happened next. They approached the landing to the nursery and had no plans for stopping to see Juliet's father, to urge him to receive his daughter on the way up. But Jeanne's changed her mind as she felt her bladder beg for release.
"Oh, I've got to go pretty bad," she told Marnes, embarrassed as a child to admit she couldn't hold it.
Her mouth was dry and her stomach churning from so much fluid and maybe from a little fear of the journey being over and done.
"I wouldn't mind seeing Juliet's father, either," she added.
Marnes's mustache bent up at the corners with the excuse.
"Then we should stop," he said.
The waiting room was empty, the signs reminding them to be quiet. Jeanne's peered through the glass partition and saw a nurse padding through the dark corridor toward her, a frown becoming a slight smile of recognition.
"Mayor,"
she whispered.
"I'm sorry not to have wired ahead, but I was hoping to see Dr. Nichols and possibly use your restroom."
"Oh, of course,"
she buzzed the door and waved them through.
"We've had two deliveries since you last stopped by. Things have been crazy with this generator mess."
"Well, power holiday,"
Marnes corrected, his voice gruff and louder than theirs. The nurse shot him a look, but nodded as if duly noted. She took two robes from the racks and held them out, told them to leave their stuff by her desk. In the waiting room, she waved toward the benches and said she would find the doctor.
"The bathrooms are through there."
She pointed at a door, the old sign painted on its surface nearly eroded clean away.
"I'll be right back," Jeanne told Marnes.
She fought the urge to reach out and squeeze his hand, as normal as that dark and hidden habit had lately become. The bathroom was almost completely devoid of light. Jeanne's fumbled with an unfamiliar lock on the stall door, cursed under her breath as her stomach churned noisily, then, finally, threw the stall open and hurried to sit down. Her stomach felt like it was on fire as she relieved herself. The mixture of welcomed release and the burn of having held it too long left her unable to breathe. She went for what felt like forever, remained sitting as her legs shook uncontrollably, and realized she had pushed herself too hard on the climb up. The thought of another 20 levels mortified her, made her insides feel hollow with dread. She finished and moved over to the adjoining toilet to splash herself clean, then dried herself with one of the towels. She flushed both units to cycle the water. It all required fumbling in the darkness, unable to see and unfamiliar with the spacing and location that were second nature in her apartment and office. She staggered out of the bathroom, on weak legs, wondering if she might need to stay one more night, sleep in a delivery bed, wait until the morning to make the climb to her office. She could barely feel her legs as she pulled open the door and returned to Marnes in the waiting room.
"Better?"
he asked. He sat on one of the family benches, a space left conspicuously beside him. Jeanne nodded and sat heavily. She was breathing in shallow pants and wondered if he'd find her weak to admit she couldn't go any further that day.
"Jeanne, are you okay?"
Marnes leaned forward. He wasn't looking at her, he was looking toward the ground.
"Jeanne, what the hell happened?"
"Hold your voice," she whispered.
He screamed instead.
"Doctor, nurse!"
he yelled. A form moved beyond the dusky glass of the nursery. Jeanne laid her head back against the seat cushion, trying to form the words on her lips to tell him to keep it down.
"Oh, Jeanne, sweetheart, what did you do?"
He was holding her hand, patting the back of it. He shook her arm. Jeanne just wanted to sleep. There was the slapping of footsteps running their way, lights turned up forbiddingly bright. A nurse yelled something. There was the familiar voice of Juliet's father, a doctor. He would give her a bed. He would understand this exhaustion. There was talk of blood. Someone was examining her legs. Marnes was crying, tears falling into his white mustache, peppered with black. He was shaking her shoulders, looking her in the eye.
"I'm okay,"
Jeanne tried to say. She licked her lips, so dry, mouth so damn dry. She asked for water. Marnes fumbled for his canteen, brought it to her lips, splashing water against and into her mouth. She tried to swallow but couldn't. They were stretching her out on the bench, the doctor touching her ribs, shining a light in her eyes. But things were getting darker anyway. Marnes clutched the canteen in one hand, rubbed her hair back with the other. He was blubbering. So sad for some reason, so much more energy than her. She smiled at him and reached for his hand, a miraculous effort. She held his wrist and told him that she loved him, that she had for as long as she could remember. Her mind was tired, losing its grip on her secrets, mouthing them to him as his eyes flowed with tears. His eyes, bright and wrinkled, peering down at her, then turning to the canteen in his hand, the canteen that he had carried, the water and poison meant for him. 9. The generator room was unusually crowded and eerily silent. Mechanics in worn coveralls stood 3 deep behind the railing and watched the first shift crew work. Juliet was only dimly aware of them. She was more keenly aware of the silence. She leaned over a device of her own making, a tall platform welded to the metal floor and arrayed with mirrors and tiny slits that bounced light across the room. The light shined on mirrors attached to the generator and its large dynamo, helping her get them in perfect alignment. It was the shaft between the two of them that she cared about, the long steel rod the size of a man's waist, where the power of combusting fuel was transformed into the spark of electricity. She was hoping to have the machines on either end of this rod aligned to within 1/1000th of an inch, but everything they were doing was without precedent. The procedures had been hurriedly planned in all-night sessions while the backup generator was put online. Now, she could only concentrate, could only hope the 18-hour shifts had been good for something, and trust in plans made back when she'd had some decent rest and could soundly think. While she guided the final placement, the chamber around her stood deathly quiet. She gave a sign, and Mark and his team tightened several of the massive bolts on the new rubber floor mounts. They were 4 days into the power holiday. The generator needed to be up and running by morning and at full power that next evening. With so much done to it, the new gaskets and seals, the polishing of cylinder shafts that had required young shadows to crawl down into the heart of the beast, Juliet was worried about it even starting up. The generator had never been fully powered down during her lifetime. Old Knox could remember it shutting itself down in an emergency once, back when he was a mere shadow. But for everyone else, the rumble was as constant and close as their own heartbeats. Juliet felt inordinate pressure for everything to work. She was the one who had come up with the idea to do a refit. She calmed herself with reassurances that it was the right thing to do, and that the worst that could happen now was that the holiday would get extended until they sorted out all the kinks. That was much better than a catastrophic failure years from now. Mark signaled that the bolts were secure, the lock nuts tightened down. Juliet jumped off her homemade platform and strolled over to the generator to join him. It was difficult to walk casually with so many eyes on her. She couldn't believe this rowdy crew, this extended and dysfunctional family of hers, could be so perfectly silent. It was like they were all holding their breath, wondering if the crushing schedule of the last few days was going to be for naught.
"You ready?" she asked Mark.
He nodded, wiping his hands on a filthy rag that always seemed to be draped over his shoulder. Juliet checked her watch. The sight of its second hand ticking around in its constant path comforted her. Whenever she had doubts about something working, she looked at her wrist. Not to see the time, but to see a thing she had fixed. A repair so intricate and impossible, one that had taken years of cleaning and setting parts almost too small to see, that it made her current task, whatever it was, feel small by comparison.
"We on schedule?"
Mark asked, grinning. "We're doing fine," she nodded to the control room. Whispers began to stir through the crowd as they realized the restart was imminent. Dozens of them pulled sound protection from their necks and settled the muffs over their ears. Juliet and Mark joined Shirley in the control room.
"How's it going?"
Juliet asked the second shift foreman, a young woman, small but fiery.
"Oh, golden!"
Shirley said as she continued to make adjustments, zeroing out all the corrections that had built up over the years. They were starting from the ground up, none of the patches and fixes of old to disguise any new symptoms. A fresh start.
"Oh, we're good to go," she said.
She backed away from the controls and moved to stand near her husband. The gesture was transparent, leaving the controls. This was Juliet's project. Perhaps the last thing she would ever try and fix in the down-deep of mechanical. She would have the honor, and the full responsibility, of firing the generator up. Juliet stood over the control board, looking down at knobs and dials that she could locate in utter darkness. It was hard to believe that this phase of her life was over, that some new one was about to begin. The thought of traveling to the uptop frightened her more than this project could. The idea of leaving her friends and family, of dealing with politics, did not taste as sweet to her as the sweat and grease on her lips. But at least she had allies up there. If people like Jeanne's and Marne's were able to get by, to survive, she figured she'd be okay. With a trembling hand, more from exhaustion than nerves, Juliet engaged the starter motor. There was a loud whine as a small electrical engine tried to get the massive diesel generator moving. It seemed to be taking forever, but Juliet had no idea what normal sounded like. Mark stood by the door, propping it open so they could better hear any shouts to abort. He glanced over at Juliet as she continued to hold the ignition, creases of worry in his brow as the starter whined and groaned in the next room. Someone outside waved both arms, trying to signal her through the glass.
Shut it off,"
Mark said. Shirley hurried over toward the control panel to help. Juliet let go of the ignition and reached for the kill switch, but she stopped herself from pressing it. There was a noise outside, a powerful hum. She thought she could feel it through the floor, but not like the vibration of old.
"It's already running!" someone yelled. "It's already running!"
Mark said, laughing. The mechanics outside were cheering. Someone pulled off their ear protection and hurled the muffs up into the air. Juliet realized the starter motor was louder than the rebuilt generator, that she'd been holding the ignition even as it had already started and continued to run. Shirley and Mark hugged one another. Juliet checked the temps and pressures on all the zeroed gauges and saw little to adjust, but she wouldn't be sure until it warmed up. Her throat constricted with emotion. The release of so much pressure, work crews were leaping over the railing to crowd around the rebuilt beast. Some who rarely visited the generator room were reaching out to touch it, almost with reverent awe. Juliet left the control room to watch them, to listen to the sound of a perfectly working machine, of gears in alignment. She stood behind the railing, hands on a steel bar that used to rattle and dance while the generator labored, and watched an unlikely celebration take place in a normally avoided workspace. The hum was magnificent. Power without dread. The culmination of so much hurried labor and planning. The success gave her a new confidence for what lay ahead, for what lay above. She was in such fine spirits and so fixated on the powerful and improved machines that she didn't notice the young porter hurry into the room, his face ashen, his chest swelling with the deep gulps of a long and frantic run. She barely noticed the way the news traveled from mouth to mouth throughout the room, spreading among the mechanics until fear and sadness registered in their eyes. It wasn't until the celebration died completely, the room falling into a different sort of quiet, one studded with sobs and gasps of disbelief, of grown men wailing, that Juliet knew something was amiss. Something had happened. A great and powerful thing had fallen out of alignment, and it had nothing to do with her generator.
Wool, Part 3, Casting Off. 1. There was a number on each of the pockets. Juliet could look down at her chest and read them, and so it occurred to her that they must be printed upside down. They were there for her to read, and for no one else. She numbly stared at them through her helmet visor while the door behind her was sealed. There was another door, a forbidden one, looming in front of her. It stood silently as it waited to be opened. Juliet felt lost in this void between the two doors, trapped in this airlock full of its brightly colored pipes, all jutting from the walls and ceiling, everything shimmering behind plastic-wrapped shrouds. The hiss of argon being pumped into the room sounded distant through her helmet. It let her know the end was near. Pressure built against the plastic, crinkling it across the bench and walls, wrapping it tightly around the pipes. She could feel the pressure against her suit, like an invisible hand gently squeezing. She knew what was to happen next, and part of her wondered how she had gotten here, a girl from Mechanical who had never cared one whit about the outside, who had only ever broken minor laws, and who would have been content for the rest of her life to live in the deepest bowels of the earth, covered in grease and fixing the broken things, little concern for the wider world of the dead that surrounds her. 2. Days earlier. Juliet sat on the floor of the holding cell, her back against the tall rows of steel bars, a mean world displayed on the wall screen before her. For the past 3 days, while she attempted to teach herself how to be Silo Sheriff, she had studied this view of the outside and wondered what the fuss was all about. All she saw out there were dull slopes of ground, these gray hills rising up toward grayer clouds, dappled sunlight straining to illuminate the land with little success. Across it all were the terrible winds, the frenzied gusts that whipped small clouds of soil into curls and whorls that chased one another across a landscape meant only for them. For Juliet, there was nothing inspiring about the view, nothing that aroused her curiosity. It was an uninhabitable wasteland, devoid of anything useful. There were no resources beyond the tainted steel of crumbling towers visible over the hills, steel it would no doubt cost more to reclaim, transport, smelt, and purify than it would to simply pull new ore from the mines below the silo. The forbidden dreams of the outside world, she saw, were sad and empty dreams. Dead dreams. The people of the up top who worshipped this view had it all backwards. The future was below. That's where the oil came from that provided their power, the minerals that became anything useful, the nitrogen that renewed the soil and the farms. Any who shadowed in the footsteps of chemistry and metallurgy knew this. Those who read children's books, those who tried to piece together the mystery of a forgotten and unknowable past, remained deluded. The only sense she could make of their obsession was the open space itself, a feature of the landscape that, frankly, terrified her. Perhaps it was something wrong with her, that she loved the walls of the silo, loved the dark confines of the down deep. Was everyone else crazy to harbor thoughts of escape? Or was it something about her? Juliet looked from the dry hills and the fog of soil to the scattered folders around her. It was her predecessor's unfinished work. A shiny star sat, balanced on one of her knees, not yet worn. There was a canteen sitting on one of the folders, safe inside a plastic, reusable evidence bag. It looked innocent enough lying there, having already done its deadly deed. Several numbers written with black ink on the bag had been crossed out, cases long since solved or abandoned. A new number stood to one side, a case number matching a folder not present, a folder filled with page after page of testimony and notes dealing with the death of a mayor that everyone had loved, but that someone had killed. Juliet had seen some of those notes, but only from a distance. They were written in Deputy Marnes's hand, hands that would not relinquish the folder, hands that clutched it madly. She had taken peeks at the folder from across his desk and had seen the splatters that faded occasional words and caused the paper to pucker. The writing amid these drying tears was a scrawl, not as neat as his notes in the other folders. What she could see seemed to crawl angrily across the page, words slashed out violently and replaced. It was the same ferocity Deputy Marnes displayed all the time now,
the boiling anger that had driven Juliet away from her desk and into the holding cell to work. She had found it impossible to sit across from such a broken soul and be expected to think. The view of the outside world that loomed before her, however sad, cast a far less depressing shadow. It was in the holding cell that she killed time between the static-filled calls on her radio and the jaunts down to some disturbance. Often she would simply sit and sort and resort her folders according to perceived severity. She was sheriff of all the silo, a job she had not shadowed for, but one she was beginning to understand. One of the last things Mayor Johns had told her had proved truer than she could imagine. People were like machines. They broke down. They rattled. They could burn you or maim you if you weren't careful. Her job was to not only figure out why this happened and who was to blame, but also to listen for the signs of it coming. Being sheriff, like being a mechanic, was as much the fine art of preventative maintenance as it was the cleaning up after a breakdown. The folders scattered on the floor were sad cases of the latter. Complaints between neighbors that got out of hand, reported thefts, the source of a poisonous batch of amateur shower gin, several more cases stemming from the trouble this gin had caused. Each folder awaited more findings, more legwork, more hikes down the twisting stairs to engage in twisted dialogue, sorting lies from truth. Juliet had read the law portion of the pact twice in preparation for the job. Lying in her bed in the down deep, her body exhausted from the work of aligning the primary generator, she had studied the proper way to file case folders, the danger of disturbing evidence, all of it logical and analogous to some part of her old job as mechanic. Approaching the scene of a crime or an active dispute was no different than walking into a pump room where something was broken. Someone or something was always at fault. She knew to listen, to observe, to ask questions of anyone who could have had anything to do with the faulty equipment or the tools that had served the equipment, following a chain of events all the way down to the bedrock itself. There were always confounding variables. You couldn't adjust one dial without sending something else a kilter. But Juliet had a skill, a talent for knowing what was important and what could be ignored. She assumed it was this talent that Deputy Marnes had originally seen in her. This patience and skepticism she employed to ask one more stupid question and stumble eventually onto the answer. It was a boost to her confidence that she had helped solve a case before. She hadn't known it then, had been more concerned with simple justice and her private grief, but that case had been job training and an interview, all in one. She picked up that very folder from years gone by, a pale red stamp on its cover reading "Closed" in bold block letters. She peeled the tape, holding its edges together, and flipped through the notes. Many of them were in Holston's neat hand, a forward-slanting print she recognized from just about everything on and inside her desk, a desk that had once been his. She read his notes about her, refamiliarized herself with a case that had seemed an obvious murder but had actually been a series of unlikely events. Going back through it, something she had avoided until now, resurfaced old pains. And yet, she could also recall how comforting it had been to distract herself with the clues. She could remember the rush of a problem solved, the satisfaction of having answers to offset the hollowness left by her lover's death. The process had been similar to fixing a machine on extra shifts. There was the pain in her body from the effort and exhaustion, offset slightly by the knowledge that a rattle had been wrenched away. She set the folder aside, not yet ready to relive it all. She picked up another and placed it in her lap, one hand falling to the brass star on her knee. A shadow danced across the wall screen, distracting her. Juliet looked up and saw a low wall of dirt spill down the hill.
This layer of soot seemed to shiver in the wind as it traveled towards sensors she had been trained to think of as important, sensors that gave her a view of the outside world she had been frightened as a child into believing was dear. But she wasn't so sure, now that she was old enough to think for herself and near enough to observe it firsthand. This up-top's obsession with cleaning barely trickled its way to the down-deep, where true cleaning kept the silo humming and everyone alive. But even down there, her friends in Mechanical had been told since birth not to speak of the outside. It was an easy enough task when you never saw it, but now, walking by it to work, sitting before this view of a vastness one's brain could not comprehend, she saw how the inevitable questions must surface. She saw why it might be important to squelch certain ideas before a stampede to the exits formed, before questions foamed on people's mad lips and brought an end to them all. Rather than ponder this further, she flipped open Holston's folder. Behind the bio tab was a thick stack of notes about his last days as sheriff. The portion relating to his actual crime was barely half a page long, the rest of the piece of paper blank and wasted. A single paragraph simply explained that he had reported to the up-top holding cell and had expressed an interest in the outside. That was it. A few lines to spell a man's doom. Juliet read the words several times before flipping the page over. Underneath was a note from Mayor Johns, asking that Holston be remembered for his service to the silo, and not as just another cleaner. Juliet read this letter, written in the hand of someone who was also recently deceased. It was strange to think of people she knew that she could never see again. Part of the reason she avoided her father all these years was because he was, simply put, still there. There was never the threat of her not being able to change her mind. But it was different with Holston and Jean's. They were gone forever. And Juliet was so used to rebuilding devices thought beyond repair that she felt if she concentrated enough or performed the correct series of tasks in the right order, that she should be able to bring the deceased back, be able to recreate their wasted forms. But she knew that wasn't the case. She flipped through Holston's folder and asked herself forbidden questions, some for the very first time. What had seemed trivial when she lived in the down deep, where exhaust leaks could asphyxiate and broken flood pumps could drown everyone she knew, now loomed large before her. What was it all about? This life they lived in underground confines? What was out there, over those hills? Why were they here, and for what purpose? Had her kind built those tall silos crumbling in the distance? What for? And, most vexing of all, what had Holston, a reasonable man, or his wife for that matter, been thinking to want to leave? Two folders to keep her company, both marked closed, both belonging in the mayor's office, where they should be sealed up and filed away. But Juliet kept finding herself returning to them rather than the more pressing cases in front of her. One of these folders held the life of a man she had loved, whose death she had helped unravel in the down deep. In the other lived a man she had respected, whose job she now held. She didn't know why she obsessed over the two folders, especially since she couldn't stomach seeing Marne's peer forlornly down at his own loss, studying the details of Mayor Jean's death, going over the depositions convinced he had a killer but with no evidence to corner the man. Someone knocked on the bars above Juliet's head. She looked up expecting to find Deputy Marnes, telling her it was time to call it a day, but saw a strange man peering down at her instead.
"Sheriff?"
he asked. Juliet set the folders aside and palmed the star off her knee. She stood up and turned around, facing this small man with a protruding gut, glasses perched at the end of his nose, his silver IT coveralls snugly tailored and freshly pressed. "Can I help you?" she asked. The man stuck his hand between the bars. Juliet moved the star from one palm to the other and reached out to accept it.
"Sorry, I'm late getting up here," he said. "There's been a lot going on. What with the ceremonies, the generator nonsense, and all the legal wrangling. I'm Bernard. Bernard Holland."
Juliet felt her blood run cold. This man's hand was so small around, it felt like it was missing a finger. Despite this, his grip was solid. She tried to pull back, but he refused to let go.
"As sheriff, I'm sure you already know the pact inside and out, so you know that I'll be acting mayor, at least until we can arrange a vote."
"I'd heard," Juliet said coolly. She wondered how this man had gotten past Marnes's desk without some sort of violence. Here was their prime suspect in Johns's death, only he was on the wrong side of the bars. And Juliet realized the same was true of her.
"Doing some filing, are you?"
He relinquished his grip, and Juliet pulled her hand away. He peered down at the paperwork strewn across the floor, his eyes seeming to settle on the canteen in its plastic bag, but Juliet couldn't be sure. "Oh, just familiarizing myself with our ongoing cases," she said. "There's a little more room in here to, well, think."
"Oh, I'm sure a lot of deep thought has taken place in this room."
Bernard smiled, and Juliet noticed his front teeth were crooked, one of them overlapping the other. It made him look like the stray mice she used to trap in the pump rooms. "Yes, well, I've found the space conducive to sorting my thoughts out, so maybe there's something to that. And besides," she leveled her eyes at him, "I don't expect it to remain empty for long. And once it's occupied, I'll be able to take leave of all this deep thought for a day or two while someone is put to cleaning."
"I wouldn't count too much on that," Bernard said.
He flashed his crooked teeth again.
"The word down below is that the poor mayor, rest her soul, plum wore herself out with this crazy climb of hers. I believe she was hiking down to see you. Isn't that right?"
Juliet felt a sharp sting in her palm. She loosened her grip on the brass star, the knuckles on both hands white from making fists. Bernard adjusted his glasses.
"But now I hear you're investigating for foul play."
Juliet leveled her eyes at him, trying not to be distracted by the reflection of the dull hills visible in his spectacles. "I suppose you should know, as acting mayor, that we're treating this very much as a murder," she said.
"Oh, my."
His eyes widened over a limp smile.
"So the rumors are true. Who would do such a thing?"
The smile grew, and Juliet realized she was dealing with a man who felt himself invulnerable. It wasn't the first time she'd encountered a dirty and outsized ego such as his. Her time as a shadow in the down deep had been spent surrounded by them. "I believe we'll find the party responsible was the one with the most to gain," she said dryly. After a pause, she added,
"Mayor?"
The crooked smile faded. Bernard let go of the bars and stepped back, his hands tucking into his coveralls.
"Well, it's nice to finally put a face with a name. I'm aware that you haven't spent much time out of the down deep, and to be honest, I've stayed much too insulated in my own office, but things are changing around here. As mayor and sheriff, we will be working together a lot, you and me."
He glanced down at the files at her feet.
"So, I expect you to keep me posted about everything."
With that, Bernard turned and left, and it required a concerted effort for Juliet to relax her fists. When she finally peeled her fingers away from the star, she found its sharp edges had gouged into her palm, cutting her and causing her to bleed. A few drops caught the light on the edge of the brass, looking like wet rust. Juliet wiped the star clean on her new coveralls, a habit born of her previous life among the sludge and grease. She cursed herself when she saw the dark spot the blood left on her new clothes. Turning the star over, she peered at the stamped insignia on its face. There were the three triangles of the silo and the word sheriff arched over top of them. She turned it over again and fingered the clasp that held the sharp spike of a pin. She opened the clasp and let the pin hinge free. The stiff needle had been bent and straightened in several places over the years, giving it a hand-forged look. It wobbled on its hinge, much like her hesitation to wear the thing. But as Bernard's footsteps receded, as she heard him say something indecipherable to Deputy Marnes, she felt a new resolve steel her nerves. It was like encountering a rusted bolt that refused to budge. Something about that intolerable stiffness, that reluctance to move, set Juliet's teeth on edge. She had come to believe that there was no fastener she couldn't unstick, had learned to attack them with grease and with fire, with penetrating oil and with brute strength. With enough planning and persistence, they always gave. Eventually. She forced the wavy needle through the breast of her coveralls and clasped the catch on the back. Looking down at the star was a little surreal. There were a dozen folders at her feet, demanding her attention, and Juliet felt, for the first time since arriving at the uptop, that this was her job. Her work at Mechanical was behind her. She had left that place in far better condition than she'd found it, had stayed long enough to hear the near-silent hum of a repaired generator, to see a shaft spin in such perfect alignment that one couldn't tell if it was moving at all. And now she had traveled to the uptop to find here the rattle and squelch and grind of a different set of gears, a misalignment that was eating away at the true engine of the silo, just as Jeanne's had forewarned. Leaving most of the folders where they were, she picked up Holston's, a folder she shouldn't even be looking at but couldn't be without, and pulled the cell door open. Rather than turn to her office, she first walked the other way toward the yellow steel entrance to the airlock. Peering through the triple-paned glass for the dozenth time in several days, she imagined the man she had replaced standing inside, wearing one of those ridiculously bulky suits, waiting for those far doors to open. What goes through a man's thoughts as he waits there alone to be cast off? It couldn't be mere fear, for Juliet had tasted that well enough. It had to be something beyond that, a wholly unique sensation. The calm beyond the pain or the numbness past the terror. Imagination, she figured, just wasn't up to the task of understanding unique and foreign sensations. It only knew how to dampen or augment what it already knew. It would be like telling someone what sex felt like, or an orgasm. Impossible. But once you felt it yourself, you could then imagine varying degrees of this new sensation. It was the same as color. You could only describe a new color in terms of hues previously seen. You could mix the known, but you couldn't create the strange out of nothing. So maybe it was only the cleaners who understood what it felt like to stand there, trembling, or perhaps not afraid one bit, as they waited for their death. The obsession with why played out in whispers through the silo. People wanting to know why they did what they did, why they left a shiny and polished gift to those who had exiled them. But that did not interest Juliet at all. She figured they were seeing new colors, feeling the indescribable, perhaps having a religious experience that only occurred in the face of the Reaper. Wasn't it enough to know that it happened without fail? Problem solved. Take it as an axiom, move on to a real issue, like what it must feel like to be the one going through it. That was the real shame of the taboos. Not that people couldn't pine for the outside world, but that they weren't even allowed to commiserate with the cleaners during the weeks after, to wonder what they had suffered, to properly express their thanks or regrets. Juliet tapped the yellow door with the corner of Holston's folder, remembering the man in better times, back when he was in love, a lottery winner, telling her about his wife. She nodded to his ghost and stepped away from the imposing metal door with its small panes of thick glass. There was a kinship she felt from working in his post, now wearing his star, even sitting in his cell. She had loved a man once and knew what that felt like. She had loved in secret, not involving the silo in their relationship, ignoring the pact. And so, she also knew what it meant to lose something so precious. She could imagine if her old lover was out there on that hill, wasting away in plain sight rather than feeding the roots, that she could be driven to cleaning, to wanting to see those new colors for herself. She opened Holston's file again as she wandered back toward her desk. His desk. Here was the one man who knew of her secret love. She had told him, once the case was settled in the down deep, that the man who had died, whose case she had helped solve, had been her lover. Maybe it was how he had gone on and on about his wife the days before. Maybe it was his trustworthy smile that made him such a good sheriff, engendering this baffling urge to divulge secrets. Whatever the cause, she had admitted something to a man of the law that could have gotten her in trouble, an affair completely off the books, a wanton disregard for the pact, and all he had said, this man entrusted with upholding these laws, was, "I'm sorry." Sorry for her loss. And he had hugged her, like he knew what she was holding inside, this secret grief that had hardened where her hidden love once lay. And she had respected him for that. Now she sat at his desk, in his chair, across from his old deputy who held his head in his hands and peered down, unmoving, at an open folder dotted with tears. All it took was a glance for Juliet to suspect that some forbidden love lay between him and the contents of that folder as well.
"It's 5 o'clock," Juliet said as quietly and gently as she could. Marnes lifted his face out of his hands. His forehead was red from resting it there so long. His eyes were bloodshot, his gray mustache caked with tears and snot. He looked so much older than he had a week ago in the down deep, when he had come to recruit her. Swiveling in his old wooden chair, the legs squeaking as if startled by the sudden movement, he glanced at the clock on the wall behind him and surveyed the time imprisoned beyond its yellowed and crazed plastic dome. He nodded silently at the ticking of the hand, stood up, his back stooped for a moment as he fought to straighten it. He ran his hands down his coveralls, reached out to the folder, closed it tenderly, and tucked it under his arm.
"Tomorrow,"
he whispered, nodding to Juliet. "See you in the morning," she said, as he staggered out toward the cafeteria. Juliet watched him go, feeling the sorriest for him. She recognized the love behind his loss. It was painful to imagine him back in his small apartment, sitting on a cot wide enough for one, sobbing over that folder until he finally collapsed into his fitful dreams. Once alone, she placed Holston's folder on her desk and slid her keyboard closer. The keys had been worn bare long ago, but someone in recent years had neatly reprinted the letters in black ink. Now, even these handwritten faces were fading and would soon need another coat. Juliet would have to see to that. She couldn't type without looking at her keyboard like all these office people could. She slowly pecked out a request to wire down to mechanical. After another day of getting little done, of being distracted by the mystery of Holston's decision, she had come to a realization. There was no way she could perform this man's job until she first understood why he had turned his back on it, and on the silo itself. It was a nagging rattle keeping her from other problems. So, instead of kidding herself, she was going to embrace the challenge, which meant that she needed to know more than his folder contained. She wasn't sure how to get the things she needed, how to even access them, but she knew people who might. This was what she missed most about the down deep. They were family there, all with useful skills that overlapped and covered one another. Anything she could do for any of them, she would. And she knew they would do the same, even be an army for her. This was a comfort she sorely missed, a safety net that felt all too far away. After sending the request, she sat back with Holsten's folder. Here was a man, a good man, who had known her deepest secrets. He was the only one who ever had. And soon, God willing, Juliet would uncover his. 3. It was well after 10 by the time Juliet pushed away from her desk. Her eyes had become too sore to stare at her monitor any longer, too tired to read one more case note. She powered down her computer, filed the folders away, killed the overhead lights, and locked the office door from the outside. As she pocketed her keys, her stomach grumbled, and the fading odor of a rabbit stew reminded her that she'd missed yet another dinner. That made it 3 nights in a row. 3 nights of focusing so hard on a job she barely knew how to perform, a job she had no one to guide her through, that she'd neglected to eat. If her office didn't abut a noisy, aroma-filled cafeteria, she might be able to forgive herself. She pulled her keys back out and crossed the dimly lit room, weaving around nearly invisible chairs left scattered between the tables. A teenage couple was just leaving, having stolen a few dark moments in the wall screen's twilight before curfew. Juliet called out for them to descend safely, mostly because it felt like the sheriff thing to do, and they giggled at her as they disappeared into the stairwell. She imagined they were already holding hands and would steal a few kisses before they got to their apartments. Adults knew of these illicit things, but let them slide. A gift each generation bestowed on the next. For Juliet, however, it was different. She had made the same choices as an adult. To love without sanction, and so her hypocrisy was more keenly felt. As she approached the kitchen, she noticed the cafeteria wasn't quite empty. A lone figure sat in the deep shadows by the wall screen, staring at the inky blackness of nighttime clouds hanging over darkened hills. It appeared to be the same figure as the night before, the one who had watched the sunlight gradually fade while Juliet worked alone in her office. She adjusted her route to the kitchen in order to pass behind the man. Staring all day at folders full of bad intentions had made her a budding paranoid. She used to admire people who stood out, but now she could feel herself wary of them. She moved between the wall screen and the nearest table, pausing to push chairs back into place, their metal feet scraping on the tile. She kept an eye on the seated man, but he never once turned toward the noise. He just stared up at the clouds, something in his lap, a hand held up by his chin. Juliet walked right behind him, passing between the table and his chair, which had been moved strangely close to the wall screen. She fought the urge to clear her throat or ask him a question. Instead, she passed on by, jangling her master key from the crowded ring that had come with her new job. Twice, she glanced back over her shoulder before she reached the kitchen door. The man did not move. She let herself inside the kitchen and hit one of the light switches. After a genial flicker, the overhead bulbs popped on and shattered her night vision. She pulled a gallon of juice from one of the walk-in refrigerators and grabbed a clean glass from the drying rack. Back in the walk-in, she found the stew, covered and already cold, and brought it out as well. She ladled 2 scoops into a bowl and rattled around in a drawer for a spoon. She only briefly considered heating up the stew as she returned the large pot to its frosted shelf. With her juice and bowl in hand, she returned to the cafeteria, knocking the lights off with her elbow and pushing the door shut with her foot. She sat down in the darkness at the end of one of the long tables and slurped on her late meal, keeping an eye on this strange man who seemed to peer into the darkness as if something could be seen out there. Her spoon eventually scraped the bottom of her empty bowl. She finished the last of her juice, and not once had the man turned away from the wall screen. She pushed the dishes away from herself, insanely curious.
The figure reacted to this, unless it was mere coincidence. He leaned forward and held his outstretched hand out at the screen. Juliet thought she could make out a rod or a stick in his grasp, but it was too dark to tell. After a moment, he leaned over his lap, and Juliet heard the squeak of charcoal on expensive-sounding paper. She got up, taking this movement as an opening, and strolled closer to where he was sitting.
"Raiding the larder, are we?" he asked.
His voice startled her. "Worked through dinner," she stammered, as if she needed to explain herself.
"Must be nice to have the keys."
He still didn't turn away from the screen, and Juliet reminded herself to lock the kitchen door before she left. "What are you doing?" she asked. The man reached behind himself and grabbed a nearby chair, slid it around to face the screen.
"You want to see?"
Juliet approached warily, grabbed the backrest, and deliberately slid the chair a few inches further from the man. It was too dark in the room to make out his features, but his voice sounded young. She chastised herself for not committing him to memory the night before when there'd been more light. She would need to become more observant if she was going to be any good at her job. "What are we looking at, exactly?" she asked. She stole a glance at his lap, where a large piece of white paper faintly glowed in the wan light leaking from the stairwell. It was spread flat across his thighs, as if a board or something hard rested beneath it.
"I think those two are going to part. Look, there."
The man pointed at the wall screen and into a mix of blacks so rich and so deep as to appear as one. The contours and shadowy hues Juliet could make out almost seemed to be a trick played by her eyes, as real as ghosts. But she followed his finger, wondering if he were mad or drunk, and tolerated the exhausting silence that followed.
"There," he whispered, excitement on his breath.
Juliet saw a flash, a spot of light, like someone flicking on a torch far across a dark generator room. And then it was gone. She bolted out of her chair and stood near to the wall screen, wondering what was out there. The man's charcoal squeaked on his paper. "What the hell was that?" Juliet asked. The man laughed.
"A star," he said. "If you wait, you might see it again. We've got thin clouds tonight and high winds. The one there is getting ready to pass."
Juliet turned to find her chair and saw that he was holding his charcoal at arm's length, staring up at the spot where the light had flashed, one eye winked shut. "How can you see anything out there?" she asked, settling back into her plastic chair.
"Well, the longer you do this, the better you see at night."
He leaned over his paper and scribbled some more.
"And I've been doing this a long time."
"Doing what, exactly? Just staring at the clouds?" He laughed.
"Mostly, yeah, unfortunately. But what I'm trying to do is see past them. Watch, we might get another glance."
She peered up in the general direction of the last flash. Suddenly, it popped back into view, a pinprick of light like a signal from high over the hill.
"How many do you see?" he asked.
"One," she told him. She was almost breathless from the newness of the sight. She knew what stars were. They were part of her vocabulary, but she'd never seen one before.
"There was a faint one just to the side of it as well. Let me show you."
There was a soft click, and a red glow spilled over the man's lap. Juliet saw that he had a flashlight hanging around his neck, a film of red plastic wrapped around the end. It made the lens look like it was on fire, but it emanated a gentle glow that didn't barrage her eyes the way the kitchen lights had. Spread across his lap, she saw a large piece of paper covered with dots. They were arranged haphazardly, a few perfectly straight lines running in a grid around them. Tiny notes were scattered everywhere.
"The problem is that they move," he told her. "If I see that one here tonight..." He tapped one of the dots with his finger.
There was a smaller dot beside it.
"At the exact same time tomorrow, it'll be a little over here."
Turning to Juliet, she saw that the man was young, probably in his late 20s. He smiled, was quite handsome, and added,
"It took me a long time to figure that out."
Juliet wanted to tell him that he hadn't been alive a long time, but remembered what it felt like as a shadow when people dismissed her the same way. "What's the point?" she asked, and saw his smile fade.
"What's the point of anything?"
He returned his gaze to the wall and doused the flashlight. Juliet realized she'd asked the wrong question, had upset him, and then she wondered if there was anything illicit in this activity of his, anything that defied the taboos. Was collecting data on the outside any different than the people who sat and stared at the hills? She made a mental note to ask Marnes about this when the man turned to her again in the darkness.
"My name's Lucas," he said.
Her eyes had adjusted well enough to see his hand stretched out toward her. "Juliet," she replied, grabbing and squeezing his palm.
"The new sheriff."
It wasn't a question, and of course he knew who she was. Everyone up top seemed to. "What do you do when you're not up here?" she asked. She was pretty sure this wasn't his job. Nobody should get chits for staring up at the clouds.
"I live in the upper mids," Lucas said. "I work on computers during the day. I only come up when the viewing's good."
He switched the light back on and turned toward her in a way that suggested the stars weren't the most important thing on his mind anymore.
"There's a guy on my hall who works up here on dinner shift. When he gets home, he lets me know what the clouds were like during the day. If he gives me the thumbs up, I come take my chances."
"And so you're making a schematic of them?" Juliet gestured toward the large sheet of paper.
"Trying to. It'll probably take a few lifetimes."
He tucked his charcoal behind his ear, pulled a rag from his coveralls, and wiped his fingers clean of black residue. "And then what?" Juliet asked.
"Well, hopefully I'll infect some shadow with my sickness and they'll pick up wherever I leave off."
"So literally, like, several lifetimes?" He laughed, and Juliet realized it was a pleasant one.
"At least," he said.
"Well, I'll leave you to it," she said, suddenly feeling guilty for talking to him. She stood and reached out her hand, and he took it warmly. He pressed his other palm to the back of her hand and held it a moment longer than she would have expected.
"Pleasure to meet you, Sheriff."
He smiled up at her, and Juliet didn't understand a word of what she muttered in return. 4. The next morning, Juliet arrived early at her desk, having stolen little more than 4 hours of sleep. Beside her computer, she saw a package waiting on her. A small bundle wrapped in recycled pulp paper and encircled with white electrical ties. She smiled at this last touch and reached into her coveralls for her multi-tool. Pulling out the smallest pick from the tool, she stuck it into the clasp of one of the electrical ties and slowly pulled the ratcheting device apart, keeping it intact for future use. She remembered the trouble she'd gotten into as a mechanic shadow the day she'd been caught cutting a plastic tie from an electrical board. Walker, already an old crank those decades ago, had yelled at her for the waste, and then had shown her how to tease the little clasp loose to preserve the tie for later use. Years had passed, and when she was much older, she had found herself passing this lesson on to another shadow named Scotty. He had been a young lad at the time, but she had lit into him when he had made the same careless mistake she once had. She remembered frightening the poor boy white as a cinder block, and he had remained nervous around her for months after. Maybe because of that outburst, she had paid him more attention as he continued his training, and eventually, the two had grown close. He quickly grew up to become a capable young man, a whiz with electronics, able to program a pump's timing chip in less time than it took her to break one down and put it back together. She loosened the other tie, crossing the package, and knew the bundle was from him. Several years ago, Scotty had been recruited by IT and had moved up to the 30s. He had become too smart for mechanical, as Knox had put it. Juliet set the two electrical straps aside and pictured the young man preparing this package for her. The request she'd wired down to mechanical the night before must have bounced back up to him, and he had spent the night dutifully doing this favor for her. She pried the paper apart carefully, Both it and the plastic ties would need to be returned. They were both too dear for her to keep and light enough to porter on the cheap. As the package came apart, she noticed that Scotty had crimped the edges and had folded these tabs under each other, a trick children learned so they could wrap notes without the expense of glue or tape. She disassembled his meticulous work with care, and the paper finally came loose. Inside, she found a plastic box, like the kind used to sort nuts and bolts for small projects down in mechanical. She opened the lid and saw that the package wasn't just from Scotty. It must have been hurried up to him along with a copy of her request. Tears came to her eyes as the smell of Mama Jean's oatmeal and cornflour cookies drifted out. She plucked one, held it to her nose, and breathed deeply. Maybe she imagined it, but she swore she noted a hint of oil or grease emanating from the old box, the smells of home. Juliet folded the wrapping paper carefully and placed the cookies on top. She thought of the people she would have to share them with. Marnes, of course, but also Pam in the cafeteria, who had been so nice in helping her settle into her new apartment. And Alice, Jean's young secretary, whose eyes had been red with grief for over a week. She pulled the last cookie out and finally spotted the small data drive rattling around in the bottom of the container, a little morsel baked special by Scotty and hidden among the crumbs. Juliet grabbed it and set the plastic case aside. She blew into the little metal end of the drive, getting any debris out, before slotting it into the front of her computer. She wasn't great with computers, but she could get around them. You couldn't do anything in mechanical without submitting a claim, a report, a request, or some other piece of nonsense. And they were handy for